Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking to the folks from Little Globe Theater, talking about the production Salve, Women on War and Warriorship, which is happening at the National Hispanic Cultural Center. And the folks from Project Treehouse will be here to tell us about their upcoming trip to Haiti. I'm delighted now to welcome Jonathan Richards, Paul Walski, and Charles Maynard. They are all part of Santa Fe Performing Arts production of Neil Simon's The Sunshine Boys, which opens this weekend and runs for 3 weekends at the Armory for the Arts. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Good morning.
It's great to have you all here. So this is a very funny play from 1972, Neil Simon.
Right.
Who was behind choosing this?
Jonathan and I think it's safe to say we wanted to work together. I certainly wanted to work with Jonathan for many years. And we were fortunate to come up with this idea because it's a fabulously funny play.
We wanted to do a play that people would want to come to see. I think that there's a lot of good theater that's done in Santa Fe, but if it's not something that is known, it doesn't necessarily get the people up off the couch and or to give up a dinner at a nice restaurant.
What constitutes known besides Shakespeare?
Well, Shakespeare is known, but doesn't perhaps draw in the same way. Paul has some experience with that recently, having done King Lear.
Yes, King Lear was something that I wanted to do all my life. I waited to get old enough. But getting people out to the theater is a major, major accomplishment if you succeed. And we felt that Neil Simon, a very popular writer.
And very funny writer.
Very funny writer. I went to the rehearsal last night. I didn't get to stay for the whole thing, but I was sitting alone in the audience cracking up, even in the first couple of scenes. Why don't you want to set up for us what the play is about?
Yes, Paul, having said that he'd waited all his life to get old enough to King Lear, it was just a short leap of faith to be old enough for The Sunshine Boys, which involves two old vaudevillians who were at the very top of the heap in their day, but vaudeville is dead. This is set in the 1970s. Vaudeville long gone, and Lewis and Clark, the duo, pretty much forgotten. They couldn't stand each other as people. They worked together for 43 years and never got along, and they haven't worked together since my character, Al Lewis, retired 11 years ago. But there's a chance to get back together again when Ben, Willie's nephew, who is an agent and wonderfully played by Hardy Pinnell, gets them a slot on a comedy special, but only if they will appear together. So the dynamic of the play is getting these two people who hate each other's guts to get back together again to do comedy.
Now, it seems a little far-fetched to imagine the two people who hated each other would have been able to do comedy in the first place. I mean, I read that the duo upon which the play was originally based was composed of two guys who actually loved each other.
The duo upon whom their relationship is based on Gallagher and Sheen, who are another long, long-running, headlining vaudeville comedy team, who apparently... So our comedy material is based on Smith and Dale, but our personal relationship is based on Gallagher and Sheen.
Okay.
Their last experience together was a significantly unhappy one. My character bears a grudge that he's been carrying heavily for 11 years. And this is the setup.
And drama ensues.
There are some fireworks, but let's bring our director, Mr.
Yes.
Charles Maynard, in here. And
well, I was brought on board because I've been directing at Santa Fe Performing Arts for a couple of years now, and I'm a student of Neil Simon. I've played Felix Unger on 3 occasions and worked both as a teacher and a student on workshops with his work.
Felix Unger, excuse me, in The Odd Couple.
The Odd Couple, yes, yeah. I remember it well.
And I love Neil Simon's work. It's written like a musical score. Every beat is like a note that needs to be there. No extra beats need to be in it. And it's funny. My goal is to have the audience hurting from laughing so hard. And I've been
If that disrupts a few beats.
Even if that disrupts, that's okay. That's written in.
Right.
And I've been lucky enough to have two actors who are professional and experienced and have been a joy to work with and are really bringing the characters to life.
Well, that's something I'd never really thought about. When a playwright writes a play in which the characters are not aware of the audience, obviously they're playing their characters, does the playwright actually allow time for the audience to laugh without missing lines?
Well, they assume there's going to be places where there's laughs, and it's written accordingly. They don't write in actually the word pause, but good actors like Paul and Jonathan know exactly how to play a laugh.
Well, anticipating, excuse me, Jonathan.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, it's what makes the preview process in New York so helpful, is because you get to find out exactly where the laughs are. Here, we'll do the first show for an audience, will be opening night, except for the chuckles that were emanating from the fourth row, second seat in last night where you were sitting. It does make that a challenge. But while we haven't done this show before, we've done, both Paul and I have done enough comedy, and certainly Charles has, to know how you stall for time, how you cover for a laugh.
Anticipating a laugh is a great danger, because if you have expectation that a laugh is coming, you hunger for it as an actor. And that's one thing that you can't do. You have to trust the playwright. Keep going. If the laugh comes, wonderful. It re-energizes you tremendously when the audience responds and laughs. But you can't anticipate it.
And you have to keep your focus. I mean, the mark of the high school actor is that when the audience starts laughing, they start laughing too.
Yeah. Well, and of course, just following up on what Paul said, and very much the same line of thinking, is that the actor has to be sure that you know how the line works, and you know how the line is to be delivered, and you don't say, gee, I got a laugh on that last night, saying this. If I say this, I'll get even more of a laugh.
Right, right.
Then the other thing that happens is there are audiences that are busy listening, and they don't want to miss a word. And so they're afraid to laugh, and they're quiet, and it's a danger for the actors to start pushing, thinking that they're not being funny, when in fact they are.
Exactly.
The audience just wants to hear what they have to say.
Well, how different is it to do, say, the dress rehearsal, and then in terms of this conversation, and then the first performance?
We know our lines on opening night.
Ah, yes, whereas in the dress rehearsal, it's anybody's guess.
I'd like to, I know you have other people coming in, I'd like to just say a word about our third, we have a wonderful cast, but Hardy Pinnell, who is the third of the, you know, heavy lifting major parts, and has really a bigger part than I do, has been absolutely wonderful. He's a young actor who is just now on the cusp of trying to decide whether that's what he's going to do with his life or something else, and he's been just a joy to work with, and I just wanted to mention him in this context.
And he plays your nephew.
Yes, he plays my nephew, and he is my savior also when I drop a line. I have a heavy burden of lines, and I have to say that I haven't yet proved that I'm not going to make any mistakes, but Hardy saves me when whatever I'm not saying leaves a big dead space in the air. He also is just about to be accepted at Columbia in a graduate program, and we're all pulling for him.
In theater.
He's in the final selection of candidates.
So we think this will put him over the top.
Santa Fe losing another actor, but anyway.
Yeah. It's just so much fun to do comedy and to do as Chuck will tell you, having specialized in Neil Simon, he gets a bit of a bad rap as an artisan, as a slick wordsmith. But the fact is, making people laugh is really a high form of, you know, as who was it? Not Edmund Kean, I think it was. Dying said, "Dying, you know, comedy is easy. Dying is hard."
Other way around. Dying is easy. Comedy is hard.
That's what I meant to say. Yes. That's why I bring Chuck along, because he's our expert.
He's the director. Now, this play was originally directed in 1972 by Alan Arkin, another Santa Fe connection.
Correct, and we have been very fortunate in that Alan has volunteered some of his time and come to rehearsals and worked with us, particularly early on, with character development and giving us his insights into the show, which were invaluable.
He actually took over the reins and directed us word by word, sentence by sentence, moment by moment, three times. And, of course, it was a brilliant experience. It was just wonderful. I'll never forget it.
I'd like to make clear that he deferred to Chuck in this process, that he said, do you want me to just sort of whisper things as I see them to you, or just speak directly to the actors? And Chuck, who has great talent but not a huge ego, was happy to step aside and let the original Broadway director come in and teach us all a little bit.
I didn't want to miss the chance to learn either from him. He's a great teacher.
Now, a 1972 play, almost 40 years old, about people who hark back to an era that no longer really exists in anybody's living memory, almost. Did you feel that you had to update it in any ways?
Not at all. Not at all. And one theme which runs in the show that is more pertinent today than it was then is the fact that we have a huge pool of talented people, valuable people, people with a lot to give in this country, and that's our senior citizens. And we tend to ignore them. And in this play, we have an example of two people who are older, still have a ton to give, still want to give what they have and share it with their family and friends and everybody else.
Just not with each other.
Just not with each other. And I think that's a great theme that carries beautifully to today.
And meanwhile, all of the some of the other not-so-happy parts of senior citizenship, like not knowing what the heck you're doing, how to open the door, how to turn your television on and keep it plugged in, and all those things are used to great comic effect.
Yes.
Right.
Mostly by Paul.
Right.
Still can't figure out how to open the door.
Yes, but I have to figure out how not to open the door for the play. And I'm not sure I've actually figured out how not to open the door yet, but by Friday night, I'll definitely be completely incompetent.
So it's opening this Friday night, The Sunshine Boys, a comedy in two acts by Neil Simon, and it runs three weekends, this weekend and the next two weekends after that, Fridays and Saturdays at 7:30, Sunday matinees at 2 in the afternoon. For more information, you can call the Armory for the Arts box office at 505-984-1370. Jonathan Richards, Paul Walski are actors, and Charles Maynard is the director. We've got just a minute or two left. Do you want to give us a little teaser of what we're going to experience? Do you guys have any dialogue?
Sugar?
I got sugar. You like a cracker?
What kind of a cracker?
Anything you want. Graham chocolate coconut.
Maybe a graham cracker.
Go in the kitchen and get it. It's in the plaza.
Maybe later. That's just a little, that's our first exchange.
Excellent. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
I'm very happy now to welcome Valerie Martinez. She is executive director and core artist in Little Globe. She's a poet and playwright and much more. And Chris Jonas joins us. He is a composer and he's the director of media and music with Little Globe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. Pleasure being here.
It's great to have you. And so the two of you are here to talk about a production that's happening this coming Saturday at the National Hispanic Cultural Center. It's a production of Little Globe called Salve, Women on War and Warriorship. So how did this whole production come into being?
It came into being several years ago in thinking about how little we actually know about the experiences of veterans. And the only reason we're focusing on women vets for this performance is that this takes place during Women and Creativity Month, which is a month-long series of events in Santa Fe and Albuquerque. revolving around ruminant creativity. But the idea was that a lot of time in the news media, there are a lot of absolutes about soldiers and war and the military and all of that. And I think Molly Sturgis, also core artist member, artistic director of Little Globe, began thinking about how little we actually know about the internal experiences of war from the perspective of veterans. And so we decided to interview veterans, men and women, and think about creating something that would honor their experiences, would explore their experiences, and that's sort of how it came about.
I think what's very interesting and important to do is to do this all in a nonpartisan and sort of non-political way, but really be about the people, about their experiences, about their emotions, about their whole life experience connected with being in war.
Yes, and I think what's interesting about the interviews is when you actually listen to these vets talk, there's such a complex configuration of where they stand in terms of the experience of war. There's a mix, especially among the women, of intense patriotism for most of them, a really strong desire, either because there's a history of military service in their families or a strong belief in the fact that soldiers fight for the freedoms that the rest of us enjoy. And oftentimes they'll say the freedom to protest, the freedom to oppose the war. They'll often talk about that's what soldiers give us the right to do. At the same time, we get through the interviews the real hard realities of what war is like. And for the women, that includes some of them have experienced sexual assault by their fellow soldiers. So in listening to the women talk, you are forced to sort of embrace the complexity of all of that at once. And so I never felt in my interviews that you had warmongers. That just didn't happen so much. You had people who believed in fighting, but it was never like that. It was never simple. And so we hope that the performance allows people to also take in and embrace the fact that our soldiers are navigating a really complicated territory in terms of their own views and perspectives and certainly experiences of war.
So you did a whole bunch of interviews.
I think between Molly and I, between us, we maybe did about 7 or 8 total.
Oh, okay. And then how did you make them into a performance?
We transcribed or took very careful notes from each interview. And for this performance, we focused on the women. And it was a matter of choosing pieces of text, passages, and then Molly particularly, she's the musician, I'm the writer, interviewer, and she took particular passages that became sort of refrains or choruses. The performance also includes, of the various of those of us who are performing and speaking, sometimes we'll read for longer periods of time good bits of a part of an interview. Sometimes we're just taking words and phrases. Sometimes we're creating sounds with syllables that become sort of pieces of the music.
It makes me think of the Laramie Project, where people were interviewed and then their real words are used on stage, but not spoken by them, spoken instead by performers.
Yes, and on the Little Globe, we have a very strong commitment to creating works of art and performance with communities. And in order for those communities to have a sense of ownership or belonging to that, we try to very much look to what's powerful and beautiful about the words that they give us and try to work with those. Sometimes we certainly edit a little, but in terms of these performances, we add very little text to what they gave us. The only difference in this year's performance is I wrote response poems to some of the text directly from theirs. But in previous years, really the text itself comes directly and only from the vets.
And you were doing live music, Chris Jonas and others as well, during the performance.
Yeah, we're the structure of the performance itself will include a number of people who are reading. Molly will be sort of the master conductor, as it were, and she'll be interleaving what's going on with the spoken word aspect along with the musical side. I'll be in charge of the musical side of things, and we'll be providing both realms of contrast. We'll be creating textures underneath which, on top of which the words go. We'll be weaving and intermixing. So in many ways, there's similarities to something like the Laramie Project or Anna DeVere Smith's work, which is
right.
almost documentary. It's sort of subjective documentary. In our case, we're really using it, in addition to is being pictures of people and their experiences, we're also using it as artistic fodder, and we're contextualizing it in a very different kind of a way. One of the things that we think about in terms of the music itself is if somebody is talking about a rather difficult thing, rather than creating scary music or, you know, rather than contextualizing it with what you'd expect music to contextualize, if it's a description of war, we're not going to create war music. We actually may look for a contrasting music to underscore another aspect of it. So we're looking at different layers of meaning and contextualization.
I was wondering, Valerie, if you might read an excerpt from one of your interviews and maybe one of your poems.
I'd be happy to. I'll actually maybe read some of the pieces, if that's okay, from the chorus or refrains that come up. I think in themselves they become like a poem, but they're from different interviews. Will there ever be a moment when it is not present in my thoughts, in my spirit, in my body? I'm a fourth generation vet, and I am proud to be a vet. I'm always checking my doors, locking my doors. I'm worried about little things. Unfortunately, everything in New Mexico looks like Iraq. I'm definitely not patriotic, never was. I just joined to get money for school, and I never agreed with Iraq. How could we do this? People see that I have all my limbs. Yes, but the wounds are in here. And then she motioned to her heart. They're inside. It's such a drastic, life-changing thing. And then you come home. And the one I answered was part of an interview of a woman who was sexually assaulted by one of her fellow soldiers. And she had a knife that she carried around at night. So I used a quote from the interview where she said, I would carry my little knife. And I wrote this poem. Because my grandfather gave it to my father, because my father gave it to my brother, because my brother in the VA, wet and twisted in white sheets, telling me, I don't want you to go, gives it to me, I carry my little knife. From Albuquerque to Texas to Alabama to Iraq, because their hands held it, because it swung in their pockets, because it whittled down, cut through, pried open, because it's rusted with jungle water, sweat, gunpowder, sand, wiped clean of blood, I carry my little knife. Because it is heirloom, kitchen tool, talisman, totem, because it is a weapon and nobody told me I would need it even at night, to get from here to the bathroom among the men in my own unit. Because I tell myself, wet and twisting in the heat, to keep my mind on the mission, the IED lying in wait, my name on a bullet. Because at the right angle, and if it was once more shiny, it would be a mirror reminding me who I am and why I'm here, eye light and maybe a tear flashing, the two of us, little knife and soldier woman, saying, I do it because I can do it, because I want the people I love to be safe.
Valerie Martinez, the performance is called SAV, Women on War and Warriorship. It is this coming Saturday, March 6th, at the National Hispanic Cultural Center at 8 in the evening. It's in commemoration of Women and Creativity Month. Let's talk more about Little Globe. This is an organization that's been around for some years now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the origins of Little Globe go back to New York City. One of Molly's first projects was working with a group of women, middle-aged women with cancer, or women who were survivors of cancer. And she was asked to create a project engaging that community. And I think one of the things that she very quickly discovered was how much that experience was an isolating one, and that, you know, the women in the ensemble who signed up to become part of the ensemble and who had never, in many cases, had never performed, or but they had sort of been egged into this position, they found themselves working together and forming a community. And she utilized a lot of experimental art forms to do this. She used video, which is one of the cores of what we do, a lot of performance, a lot of personal narrative, and experimental movement and set building and things like that. That was such a positive experience, and it was so life-changing for Molly and the rest of us who were part of it, as well as the ensemble itself, which, by the way, the ensemble, and this is probably 12 years later, the ensemble still is an active group, supporting one another, but also performing. Since then, Molly went on to create a number of projects like this, and we formed a nonprofit to help to support those projects as well as our own personal projects. And so in the early days of Circus Luminous, Little Globe was one of the producing partners. And we've done a whole array of different things. I think the time that Val came on board in the most singular way was a project for the Santa Fe Opera, Memory Lines,
right,
in which we were asked to do a piece about Santa Fe. And rather than doing what people expected, we did a semi-random selection of people from the community and formed an ensemble.
What do you think people expected?
Well, I think that the hopes were, it was a Santa Fe Opera Commission. They hoped that there would be one of us as the composer, we'd have a classic, you know, opera production team.
Okay.
And that we'd have professional performers on stage, you know, singing the songs of Santa Fe. And
Ari is about chili.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly, and mariachis and
right.
Pueblo dances, the whole nine yards. It ended up actually becoming a very interesting meditation on the identity of what it is to be a Santa Fean, which in my mind, after these many years of quite a number of now Little Globe explorations of community and identity, it's very much of an individually dictated kind of thing. You know, we are in many cases who we are as a component of where we're from, but in many other cases, we're also many other things. Sometimes we have conflicting things internally, you know. Somebody will say you're from this one specific demographic, and the truth of the matter is that there's a lot more to the story than that. And I would say that Little Globe has really engaged those kinds of issues.
Yeah, I think opening up the complexity of what can be oversimplified identity politics is a really good thing.
Yeah, and we should say about Memory Lines and most of our projects is that we work with people in the community. So the 24 people, community residents in Memory Lines, were people who wouldn't ordinarily probably share the same space. And we also work longer term. So we worked from January, two sessions a week from January to June, where this ensemble came together. And we explore creatively. So we don't come together and have discussions about community. We basically come together and share food and engage in creative exercise that involve all the different mediums, from film to visual art to poetry and writing, music. And so that what we've seen happen is that people work together. That seems to be very, very important, is that actually even before we're prepared, if we need to talk about some of the tough issues, what we learn to do is to collaborate. And Little Globe sessions require everyone, including us, to take some risks where, you know, I always talk about with Memory Lines, you know, I'm a poet. I mean, really, if I had my way, though I do a lot of performing now, I would be in a room and writing poems. And I was moving and composing with my mouth and doing all kinds of things that were, for me, pushing the envelope. And there are people in the ensemble who wouldn't call themselves artists. And what you see in that process is you learn to be vulnerable around each other. You learn to depend on each other. You create things together. And there's something really powerful about what that does to people in a group, because you start to learn what you can do together before you identify each other as coming from a certain political perspective or a point of view. And so what we've seen is that builds capacity. It builds connections between people, but it also builds a certain capacity for the group. And so Memory Lines was really a collaboration of the core artist team, those of us in 24. And the performance, the content of the performance, what Chris is talking about, what was hard for the opera and the other, some of the other sponsors to understand is they'd say, well, what is this going to be about, this opera? And we'd say, we don't know. We're going to watch and see what emerges.
Right.
And that was difficult for them to wrap their mind around. What do you mean you don't know? We don't know what it's going to be about. We actually don't even know what the music's going to be like, because that's going to depend on the ensemble, too. We don't know what the text is going to be like. We watched that emerge.
And it was a very successful performance. Everybody loved it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think the audience, our response from the audience is that people were deeply moved. Because they, well, for all the reasons we felt that way about it, because we discovered, too, what people thought and what they made together. And
I mean, I think we create opportunities for both, initially, an ensemble, within an ensemble, to develop affinities, empathy between people. Oftentimes, empathy between people who would normally prejudge one another and be afraid of one another, to develop an empathetic relationship in which they can support one another, love each other. I think it's interesting. And then you can build an artistic content around and about that.
And you can also start bringing together community members who have had divisions or haven't really been in contact with each other, and for reasons that might have been just old and stale, but they're still not talking to each other.
And I think that there's something that's very emotionally moving about engaging that exact realm. I mean, one of the things about Little Globe is we don't shy away from really difficult things. And I don't. And as you remember, probably a lot of the content that came out as a consequence of the Memory Lines project was about immigration,
right,
and about the relationship between recent immigrants into Santa Fe and those of us who have been here for a longer period of time. That was a very difficult arena, particularly that year. I mean, that was the year in which, you know, the immigration moved in and set up camp here.
And raids and
that was the spring of those raids.
And that was a pretty central theme that emerged from that project as a consequence. And those are, you know, and the same thing when it comes to sexual abuse in the military, any kind of realm like that. I mean, we don't go in looking for those things, but invariably by opening the door, we find some of those things. And we don't, like I said, we don't shy away from them.
Well, I think what happens is we create a safe space, hopefully a safe space for people to engage. And what happened with the immigration raids is they came about 2 months into the project. So we had 2 months of meeting together twice a week. And one Saturday for me, it's an unforgettable Saturday, was after the week of those raids. And some of the people in the ensemble came, including a family or two, who were terrified.
Yeah.
And who had just a horrific week. And there the whole ensemble was sitting, and there was a space for them to come to. There was a space that they knew and they felt safe in, though we had not talked, I think, openly about politics or immigration. And certainly in that room were people who reflected the whole spectrum of perspectives on immigrants and immigration. We actually know that. But because the group had formed bonds at that point, still fairly early, we could hold that as an ensemble and listen to people's stories and feel them, as Chris is talking about, feel their genuine fear and sadness and grief and all of that. And I remember that being a turning point in the project, because in some ways it didn't determine all of the content of Memory Lines, but what some people remark as the most emotionally evocative moment in that opera, which was consisted of screens in a circle, and you just saw the shadows of body parts pressing along the screen. It was a very powerful moment. And so that's kind of how we think about our work. The same thing again with Sav, which is a little bit different, it's smaller, but then we did a project in the Cuba, Ojo Encino, Torreon area with
Cuba, New Mexico,
yeah. Yes, with about 150 people, but an 80-member ensemble, ages 5 through 87, I think, who created a festival. And so we believe in this work because I think we all feel the meaning of it and the beauty of it. But one other thing I just want to mention is we're also working, I think, when we like to think about in a rigorous way as artists. The process of these projects, I think, is, for me as an artist, rigorous because it's an intense, sustained process of creative engagement and community engagement. But I think what Chris is talking about, the music for Sav in some ways, is you won't find what's maybe predictable or traditional. So we, as artists, core artists and individual artists, are working what we hope is in interesting ways and rigorous ways as artists, and that I hope belongs to all of our projects. We do talk about, like, we wish that, I think, don't you think, Chris?
Absolutely, and I think that one of the, you know, in terms of the development and the growth of Little Globe, I think a place that we're coming to is the work itself is growing, the support for the work is growing, but each one of us as artists are growing as well. Mm-hmm. And you would think that there could be a potential split in that, you know, any one of our careers could be growing to the point where we just don't have time for Little Globe style work anymore. But what's interesting is I think that in many ways our own personal expression is getting even deeper into the classic Little Globe community collaboration style work, where we are bringing more artistic rigor to it.
And which is very important, because all the great content in the world is not fun to watch if it's not done in a way that is artistically really viable and, as you say, rigorous.
And it's also not satisfying for the performers or the artists.
Right.
I mean, one of the things I love doing, like, for example, you know, we're talking about the Cuba project, which is an ongoing project. Last year, the musical ensemble consisted of whoever wanted to come and be a part of the musical ensemble. And rather than writing music and then forcing people to play that music, what we did is I found out what they could play, what they like playing. And so we had a number of teenagers who were into Navajo kids who were into death metal. So that was an absolutely integral part to the project. We had ensemble members who knew traditional sort of folk stuff on guitar. We included that. We had folks who were deeply into Native American flute playing and things like that. And so we had this very unusual libretto.
That's so cool.
And the orchestra itself consisted of, you know, a death metal bass player and a folk guitar player and a Native American flute player and percussionist and a social organizer who plays viola. And it was a pretty wonderful thing. As a consequence, for me as an artist, I had a palette of things that I was working with that I would never, ever have. I never had such an opportunity to work with musical components like that. And
it hung together.
And it totally hung together, and it created, in some ways, I think it recontextualized what was going on stage in a way that was very exciting and fresh and different.
Well, it is true. I think one of the things we're conscious of is sometimes when people talk about community art, you know, there's art with a capital A and community art with a small C and small A, and that people tend to think of community art as maybe what you're saying, straightforward, even maybe simplistic, things like that. And so we're trying to explore where that isn't.
Yeah.
You know, where the idea of community art, community performance, so to speak, is still working in very interesting ways.
Chris Jonas is the director of media and music with Little Globe. He's a composer and video artist. Valerie Martinez is a poet. She's the executive director and another core artist in Little Globe. And their upcoming performance this coming Saturday, the 6th of March at 8 in the evening, is called Sav, Women on War and Warriorship. And it's at the National Hispanic Cultural Center in Albuquerque. I want to thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
I'm very happy now to welcome Greg Schneider and Joe Shortsleeve, who are with Project Treehouse, and Kirsten McGee, who's a nurse. All three of them are about to go to Haiti. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Now, Greg and Joe, we've had you on before. You're mm-hmm. both from St. John's College and have been working with Haitian people in the past before the last great disaster. What have you been doing down there?
Well, for the last 3 years, we've gone down as part of kind of an alternative spring break project. And so groups of students, along with a few supervising adults, have gone down, and we've participated in ongoing activities with a local organization in Haiti that runs some medical clinics, that sponsors schools, that has a reforestation project, that does other economic development activities like a goat distribution project, a microloan project. And so we've gone to support those activities and also to run a series of mobile health clinics for the local population.
And so as a St. John's student, this has been a really big part of your college experience, Joe.
It was. I actually am no longer a St. John's College student, but it has been an incredible learning experience. I've gotten a lot out of the trips, and it's just been, you know, unbelievably valuable.
I think one of the things that people kind of need to remember is that Haiti was in really bad shape before the earthquake.
It's true. Yeah, it's been in bad shape for a long time, and it's really nice to be a part of, I guess, this aid effort, because it tries really hard to think very carefully about how to do service learning and aid, you know, right. It's really easy to do those things wrong, but I think everybody involved understands that there's a lot to be thought about, and there's a lot of consideration that goes on between the local nonprofit Sanjay Haiti and our partnership as Americans in this case, which is really nice to see.
Gregory, what are you going to be doing when you go there? And we're going to do a follow-up when all of you come back.
Well, this trip we had to reconfigure. After the horrible tragedy of the earthquake, we decided not to have a student trip this year. For a number of reasons, our partner on the ground, Sanjay Haiti, asked us to really bring skilled workers. And similarly, the State Department and other people have recommended that this is a time when we should really be thoughtful about who goes to see Haiti. And so we reconfigured this trip to be a team of 10 people, two physicians, two nurses, a couple of public health specialists, and then a smaller economic development team. And our main efforts are going to be on the healthcare front. We're going to provide 5 different all-day mobile health clinics, mainly for refugees in the northern part of Haiti. We are not actually going into Port-au-Prince. We're going into a larger town on the north coast called Cap-Haitien, where they're dealing with tens of thousands of refugees of their own. And so we'll be providing health care for them and some of the local villages in that area. The economic development team will also be working with our partner on the ground, Sanjay Haiti, to help do an assessment of economic needs given the new influx of refugees and an assessment of Sanjay T's ongoing activities to assess effectiveness and recommendations for future directions.
Kirsten McGee is joining us by phone. Now, have you been involved in post-disaster healthcare, Kirsten?
No, I haven't done this before, so this is very new for me, but fortunately we're going with all these guys that you're speaking with now and some of the others that are really experienced with this kind of work, so I'm really looking forward to working together with them and learning from them as well.
What kind of health care do you anticipate that people are going to be needing?
From talking with the others, I think it's going to be very basic kind of primary health care, looking at malnutrition, sanitation issues, looking at kids that are dehydrated, skin issues, just really simple stuff that we could hopefully treat easily while we're there.
Do you have to bring all the resources and medicines with you?
As far as I am? Oh, I'll leave it to you, Greg.
No, thank you. We are bringing some things in that are easier to bring from the States, but for the most part, and this is something we've also tried to do in past trips, we've tried to support the local pharmaceutical manufacturers. So we try and buy as many of the medications as we can in Haiti, but there are certain medical supplies, wound care supplies, skin care supplies, certain multivitamins, and other nutritional support items that we are going to be bringing with us because they're harder to find in Haiti itself. But basic primary care medications actually you can find in Haiti, and so we try and buy all of those medicines locally as much as possible.
Have you been in contact with people whom you have made connections with on past trips?
Yeah, absolutely. The first year we went, we met Gabrielle Vincent, and she has since started Sanjay IT. She is the founder, and we've been in contact with her for 3 years now. I've gotten to know her really well. And it's her organization, you know, that we always work with now when we go down to Haiti. But
what is the nature of the partnership between you? I mean, you've started this nonprofit called Project Treehouse. How do you partner with the Haitian organization?
Right. So Project Treehouse is originally designed to be a framework for doing these service learning trips. And we've always partnered with Sanjay IT as the local group on the ground when we go to Haiti. This year it's been not so much a service learning trip, but a different kind of relief trip. But because we have that several years experience already with Sanjay IT, and they have local resources, and it makes it a little bit easier for us to get on the ground and hopefully be able to do some good. Gabrielle, was actually with some staff members from Sanjay IT in Port-au-Prince when the earthquake struck, and they all survived, but it was a pretty touch and go, and they slept on the streets for some time, and they were part of a refugee caravan back up to the north of Cap Haitien, where they're from, and the stories, as you might imagine, are pretty harrowing, but at least the people that we have the most direct contact with, we've since reinstitute contact with, and they're all okay, but it's a pretty overwhelming situation.
Right. Kirsten, what drew you to decide to go to Haiti?
I've been a nurse for 9 years now, and it's the kind of work I've always wanted to be involved in, but I guess I haven't really pursued the opportunity. And about a week after the earthquake, a friend of a friend who had met one of the people who worked with Sanjay IT, made contact with me asking if I'd be interested, and it just was something that I was very keen to do. There's just this huge need, and I'm not currently working up here at the moment, so it just makes sense to be where the need is right now.
Gregory, there. Thank you. There is a benefit coming up that people who are listening to the show can go to actually support this work of going, of sending you guys to Haiti.
Right. Thank you for asking. On next Wednesday, March 10th, we are, thanks to Evangelos, who is hosting a benefit event for us. Wednesday evening, Soul Man Sam and the Soul Explosion are going to play a benefit concert for our trip to Haiti. The doors will open at 8 o'clock. The show should start around 8:30. I think it's a 21 and over event with a $5 cover, but Evangelos has agreed to donate a portion of the proceeds for our trip, and so we're very thankful to Evangelos, and we encourage people to come out if they get a chance.
So that's Wednesday, a week from tonight, and Greg Schneider, Joe Shortsleeve, and Kirsten McGee are all on their way to Haiti. We thank you for being here and looking forward to hearing your report when you return.
All right, thank you very much for having us.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having us here.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. My email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan features the monthly Women in Jazz Hour. Welcome back, John Greenspan.